morning. Welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Republicans say the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump is unconstitutional. And any remarks Trump made at the rally on January 6th about the election were protected by free speech. They deny he played any part in the inciting the deadly insurrection that erupted at the U.S. Capitol. Their filing also states that the case is moot because they say the Senate lacks jurisdiction to remove from office a man who is not in office. In a brief submitted by House Democrats, Trump's actions are described as, quote, a betrayal of historic proportions. The article of impeachment charged that Trump incited the insurrection with a fiery speech before a violent mob invaded the Capitol and left multiple people dead. Trump spent months denying the legitimacy of the election and pleaded with Georgia officials to, quote, find votes to allow him to win that state, the article of impeachment charges. The only honorable path at that point was for President Trump to accept the results and concede his electoral defeat, the article states. Instead, he summoned the mob to Washington, exhorted them into a frenzy, and aimed them like a loaded cannon down Pennsylvania Avenue. Well, political analysts examining the arguments on both sides tend to agree that regardless of the case put forth, Democrats will fall short of the 17 Republicans needed to convict Trump in the Senate. Shelley Inglis is the executive director of the University of Dayton, Ohio's Human Rights Center and research professor of human rights and law. In a recent article, Attorney Inglis writes that some Republican lawmakers in the House were afraid to vote to impeach Donald Trump out of fear for their lives. Professor Inglis joins us now from her home in Dayton. Good morning, Shelley Inglis.
Good morning, Verna. Thanks for having me.
So, Shelley, were the fears of Republican lawmakers credible, or were they just using that as sort of a political cover so they wouldn't have to go on record for impeachment and risk losing Trump's supporters? I mean, after all the Republicans, some of the Republicans were being herded around by the Capitol Police and crouching down behind the seats in the chamber during the insurrection, right along with the Democrats. One would think they would want to bring some sort of punishment for this behavior that contributed to that.
Yeah, so Verna, it's complicated, and that's why I wrote the article, because there's a big level of tolerance in the United States generally for interpersonal and political violence, as you know, much more than in most other functioning democracies in Europe, in Canada, Australia, and other places. And over the past 4 years, during the Trump administration, there were clear signs that political violence was, taking place more frequently, and that the rhetoric and the norms, the behavior of allowing people to dehumanize other Democrats or to actually attack people within the Republican Party if they weren't agreeing with the president, this kind of behavior became much more acceptable than we have seen Berkeley. And so the allegations that there are death threats, and, you know, I don't work for the FBI, so I can't tell you whether each individual death threat is credible. But the allegations that there are death threats on both sides and this heightened level of fear, level of concern about people's safety, either fear politically or fear for physical safety, really is in line with what we've been trending towards in the past 4 years.
No, but the question about credibility is more aimed at, do you think that the Republicans are seriously concerned about their lives, or is it more their political lives that they're trying to protect?
Right. What's happened in the last 4 years is these things have been merged in quite a significant way. So you've seen in international ratings, you've seen the Republican Party in certain areas of liberalism, for example, really trend towards looking much more like an authoritarian party in Hungary or or Turkey, which means they are willing to use sort of tactics of eroding democratic institutions to retain power. They're willing to use heightened levels of rhetoric, more appeals to violent type rhetoric or to demonizing others. So you've seen this trend throughout the 4 years. And what that does, as psychologists tell us about sort of ways in which radicalization work or how intergroup dynamics work, is where leaders are willing to demonize others, present themselves as victims of their in-group, is really at risk or at threat from another out-group, then it creates within that in-group a dynamic where people become more extremely focused on the in-group and more willing to take sort of more violent or more extreme actions to protect their group. So this idea that Republicans or Donald Trump have been victimized over the past 4 years by the media, by Democrats, by Black Lives Matter movement, by others, has really taken on a very strong role in the narrative within the Republican Party. And what that happens is it reinforces itself, right? Rather than people being able to break out of that, actually, that is a reinforcing factor, which is why most analysts say prevent violence, because once violence or extreme acts take place, then they are reinforcing of themselves and make it harder for the party to turn away from the dynamics that have been generated over the past 4 years.
So you write, Shelley, that these threats are not coming from a place of anger. I mean, because we've known about the angry white man backlash for years now, but you seem to be suggesting that it's being used manipulatively to force a loyalty to Trump. And you write of democracy deteriorating right in front of our eyes through the Republican Party. Can you expound on that?
Yeah, I think the role that this kind of that norms play in groups, right? The role that rhetoric plays in groups is that it creates what is acceptable and what should people expect. And it changes people's behavior depending on the level of acceptability of certain types of violent rhetoric, or as I said, bullying, or mistrust of institutions, of focusing on others. And this dynamic has created within the Republican Party, it seems, from looking at all the indication and the evidence, this reinforcing sense of victimization against the really a dehumanizing of Democrats or people who might disagree, or social justice movements. And that, I think, has plus, you know, taking into account that there has been a considerable amount of appeal to the more extreme and pre-existing extreme right-wing groups that we have in the United States. Mm-hmm. They were certainly not created by the Republican Party by any stretch of the imagination. Therefore, that appeal to those groups on this sort of level of extreme patriotism and this effort to demonstrate that the election, which is the core, you know, faith in the electoral process is a core aspect of our democracy, to demonstrate the election was stolen, to indicate that, in fact, this group of people is under threat, that the country is being taken away from them through nefarious means, is quite an extreme form of rhetoric and really has played into a lot of the pre-existing extremist views exist in groups.
So given that you write about political violence and the cycles and the trends, were you surprised, Shelley, by the horrific attack on the Capitol?
I think there was plenty of indication, and political violence scholars and experts had been sounding the alarm throughout the fall, both prior to the actual election. So there were lots of articles around how Americans' views, regular Americans' views, were getting more extreme, that a large percentage or a much larger percentage of Republicans and Democrats would be willing to imagine some form of violence to reach political party ends. And there were a lot of experts really looking at the trend around this Stop the Steal, this big lie, it's called, around radicalization, both conspiracy theories, but the right-wing media and the words of the Republican Party, including Donald Trump, that there were really huge signs that this was going to happen.
You weren't surprised. Is it fair to say you weren't surprised?
Looking at it in context, I was not surprised. Of course, I was horrified to see it actually take place, as we all were. So it is not that I wasn't personally deeply concerned by watching it, but I wasn't surprised in a way that, I wasn't okay. surprised.
So there were, you write about four interconnected factors that make a society vulnerable to violence aimed at political systems and decision-making. Elite factionalism, societal polarization, weakened democratic institutions due to erosion of public trust, and hate speech and militant rhetoric. So how does that leave us? How do we solve this problem? We have all these factors having taken place over the last 4 years.
I think that's right. We have a significant amount of work to do around these four factors. I mean, the hate rhetoric and the hate speech, that rhetoric can a lot of that can be controlled in the sense that if leadership changes and the type of language that is being used out of leadership changes, then that can indicate that what the type of rhetoric that we were hearing for the past 4 years is not acceptable. And there is going to be work, and there is work going on around working on domestic extremism and de-radicalization, and that's very important. The concern, the deep concerns lie in the other three factors, which is elite factionalization, which is really when elites in government and in places of power use those places of power to demonize the other side, not on differences of policy, but on, looking at them as certainly an existential threat. And that has gotten to a level in the United States that's very concerning. Social polarization we have in the United States pre-existing this time, and it's baked into some of our electoral and other institutional processes, but that plays very much into the weakening democratic institutions, which has happened through, people mistrusting this social polarization and now this high level of distrust of our institutions, including now our electoral process, in which, arguably a significant portion of the United States population believe that our electoral process is fundamentally fraudulent. Uh-huh. And also on the other side of our institutions, such as law enforcement or the Department of Justice, are significant.
Well, let me ask you this, Diane, I'm sorry, Shelley, because it seems like bipartisanship is being offered up as a resolution in terms of mending the country, bringing the two, mending the great divide between the red states and the blue states. Do you see bipartisanship as a critical part of, regaining the democracy?
I think it has to happen, Virna, at all levels. I mean, I think the first thing is on a human level, we have to rehumanize everyone in the United States, be really talking about the humanity of people within the United States and profound concerns and issues we have around security, around the health of our economy, around our public health crisis. I mean, it's really important that we place human and rehumanize everyone first. I think the second thing that can be done is more structural work, structural reforms. And I would love to see at the local level more participatory democracy where, citizens are asked to really discuss issues, policy issues in a much more meaningful way rather than partisanship. And then at a national level, you've seen a lot of conversation around what we need to do. Bipartisanship is one dimension, but it certainly isn't a holistic view of what needs to happen. I think there's obviously a need for some level of accountability. And there is also the need for some level of structural reform. And finally, there's the need for some level of truth and managing misinformation, disinformation, and coming back to a level of agreement around what the truth is.
Okay. Shelley Inglis, the executive director of the University of Dayton Human Rights Center and research professor of human rights and law. Shelley Inglis, thank you so much for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you, Verna. Have a great day.
Thank you.